Welcome to ID the Future. I am Brian Miller, and today I will be talking with Michael Flannery. And Professor Flannery is a fellow with the Center of Science and Culture and a professor emeritus of UAB Libraries. Today we'll be discussing the connection between Darwin's theory of evolution and the philosophy of materialism. Michael, welcome to the show.
Hello, Brian.
Now, my first question for you is that Darwin's theory of evolution is generally regarded as one of the great scientific theories of the modern age. Could you kind of share a little bit about what you think the likely sources of Darwin's materialism are?
Well, I think if we look at Janet Brown's two-volume biography in volume two called The Power of Place, she says that Darwin was profoundly conditioned to become the author of a doctrine inimical to religion. Well, you know, why does she say that? Well, Darwin's methodological naturalism was the engine that drove an implicit commitment to a materialistic metaphysic, I think. And the sources of this were largely twofold. First, if we go back to what we might say Darwin's origins, we can look at his paternity. His father, Robert, was a well-to-do physician, but he was a rather worldly deist. He did not have strong religious convictions. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, wrote a two-volume work on what was then popularly called transmutation, a book called Zoonomia, which was published in 1794. And young Charles read that rather carefully. And I think if we look at his parental background, he came from, at least on the paternal side of his family, a family that was not strongly rooted or grounded in, say, religious thinking or religious life. They tended to be deists, sort of a hands-off idea that, yes, there's a God out there, but God doesn't really get involved in human affairs and that sort of thing. But then secondly, I think we have to go to young Darwin's early experiences as a failed teenage medical student at the University of Edinburgh. And Darwin was sent by his father. His father, of course, as I mentioned before, was a physician. So he thought, well, you know, perhaps he could get his son involved in medicine. His older brother was already going to the University of Edinburgh. So he sent Charles to Edinburgh into medical school when he was only 17. And so when Charles is there, he petitions for entry into a society called the Plinian Society. It was a loose-knit body of free thinkers, and he petitioned for entry into that in November of 1826. Now, through the Plinians, he was going to be exposed to some of the most heretical views of the day. In fact, at the very meeting in which William Brown, who had proposed Charles for membership minutes before, he heard William Brown deliver a talk countering Charles Bell's essays on the anatomy of expression, which had been published in 1806, insisting that the Creator had endowed the human face with a form and structure uniquely suited to the expression of human emotion. Well, Brown thought that was anatomical chauvinism to assume that any special difference between animal and human facial anatomy existed. And then the next week he heard William Gregg, another fellow student, and just as iconoclastic as Brown, give a presentation setting out to prove that the lower animals possess every faculty and propensity of the human mind. So that was even sort of more off the wall. Well, then on March 27th, Brown returned to give an inflammatory lecture on mind and matter, and then Brown told the students that mind and consciousness were merely the result of brain activity. And this was pretty radical stuff back then. So this was seen as so potentially dangerous that it was actually struck from the Society's minute book. Now, just a few heretical lectures would hardly be enough to set young Charles, off down the road toward radical materialism. But his relationship with Robert Edmund Grant was different. Now, Robert Edmund Grant was 16 years older than Darwin. He was a fellow Plinian. He was an expert on aquatic invertebrates, and he would sort of took Darwin under his wing. And not only would he learn something about aquatic invertebrates, but he gained something else, too. Adrian Desmond and James Moore, in their biography of Darwin, say that they refer to the Darwin-Grant meeting as a decisive meeting. They said Darwin was coming under the wing of an uncompromising evolutionist. Nothing, they say, was sacred for Grant, and he saw no spiritual power behind nature's throne. The origin and evolution of life were due simply to physical and chemical forces, all obeying natural laws. So when we look at his background and we wonder, you know, where is this materialism, these ideas coming from? Well, they're coming from ideas that he's, you know, learning probably at his father's knee. We don't know exactly that his father certainly wasn't a strict materialist, but he's certainly gaining a lot of secular ideas. And then he goes off to the University of Edinburgh and comes under the influence of fellow Plinians who are giving all kinds of sort of materialistic lectures. And then he comes under the wing of Robert Edmund Grant, who even furthers this idea. So, by now, even at a very early age, Darwin has at least been introduced to the fundamental principles of materialism.
Oh, that's very interesting. Now, how do you feel that this influence of materialism on Darwin affected his development of the theory of evolution?
Well, he had, again, this sort of secular worldview. And this is not the idea that we get when we read Darwin's autobiography. It was posthumously published in 1887. Darwin died in 1882. And a careful perusal of his private notebook shows that even in its earliest development, Darwin's evolutionary theory was really founded upon some materialistic assumptions. Now, Howard Gruber, who has written on Darwin and man, frankly admits that Darwin presented himself in ways that aren't supported by the evidence of his notebooks. And in fact, his actual way of working would never have passed muster in a methodological court of inquiry among Darwin's scientific contemporaries. Now, that's Gruber. He says that Darwin amassed a lot of his purported evidence after his views were well established. So if you read Darwin's autobiography, you get the idea that Darwin was this tireless, unbiased investigator, patiently following the accumulating pieces of data wherever they may lead. But that's largely a fiction that was perpetrated by Darwin himself. Darwin seemingly forgot in his autobiography, in his first notebooks, that he wrote that if his evolutionary theory were correct, and if conjecture was allowed to, in his words, run wild, then we animals and humans may all be netted together. So Darwin's human-animal continuity that he did not unveil publicly until his Descent of Man in 1871 really dates from his notebooks back in 1837. Much less would he have been willing to recall that this netting of all together, as he put it, in a purposeless flux, and especially the netting of man into just another species, was his chief inspiration from almost the moment he stepped off the Beagle, because my argument would be that even before he got on the Beagle, he had sort of a mental template of what the materialistic worldview was going to look like. Now, I'm not necessarily saying he was materialist before he stepped off the Beagle, but I'm saying the evidence that he was going to amass while he was on that around-the-world voyage was going to be fit into a template that had already sort of been prepared for a materialistic scenario. And, you know, the chief target in the notebooks is man's mind. Darwin refers to it as the citadel, which was to be conquered by his evolutionary theory if its materialism was going to be victorious. And this comes out in his early notebooks. It's also hard to take Darwin's claim that his old walking partner, Robert Edmund Grant, left little impression on him. That's what he claimed in his autobiography. Shortly after the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species, Grant published his own book called Tabular View of the Primary Divisions of the Animal Kingdom, which came out in 1861. And he actually had a dedicatory letter reminding Charles Darwin of their, in his words, their common labors nearly 40 years ago in the same rich field of philosophic inquiry. Well, I don't think Grant was talking about inquiry into aquatic invertebrates. I think he's talking about their strolls, talking about, you know, the material basis of nature and the role of chance and the role of chemistry and blind operations of physical laws and so forth and so on. Even Darwin's biographer, Janet Brown, says that Darwin, it now turns out, was well aware of evolutionary views and perfectly capable of grasping the full implications of what Grant had to say. And he was prepared for that really by his own grandfather's book on transmutation called Zoonomia, which I had mentioned earlier. So an examination, if we look at the actual historical sequence of events, shows that Darwin's account in his autobiography is either, I mean, there's only one of two ways to look at it. He was self-delusional or he was being disingenuous. Gertrude Himmelfarb points out in her book, in Darwin and the Darwinian Revolution, that Darwin's notebooks from 1836 to 1839 and later show that he was speculating boldly from the very beginning. And as I already mentioned, Howard Gruber's book, Darwin on Man, just said that the way Darwin claimed he was working and the way he actually worked, when you look at his notebooks, are two different things. So, you know, Gruber emphasizes that there's misunderstandings that arise from Darwin's desire to defend his unpopular views by suggesting that he had been driven to them by a mass of unassailable evidence, rather than the less acceptable reality that much of his evidence had been patiently assembled, but only after his views were well developed. Well, why less acceptable? Well, because Gruber, and indeed Darwin himself, understood that the speculation prior to evidence might well invite the charge that the alleged facts were merely arranged to fit the theory rather than the other way around, as sort of cutting the toes to fit the shoe, as it were. So the arguments I have made demonstrate that Darwin was introduced to the metaphysics of materialism and methodological naturalism long before he was gathering evidence about evolution. And so the theory he ultimately constructed looked a lot like the ideas he had heard advanced by the Plinians and by Robert Edmund Grant. And we shouldn't be surprised at that. Now, this isn't to suggest that Darwin took his philosophical commitments lightly. I don't think he did. I think they weighed heavily upon him. Desmond and Moore in their biography refer to him as the tormented evolutionist, and I think he was. In a letter to Joseph Hooker, he admitted it's like confessing a murder of English society's most cherished beliefs, and these beliefs provided the moral glue that held civil society together. Even Darwin was concerned that he was confessing the murder of God himself. So they did bother Darwin, but at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, you know, where did Darwin come down on this religious question? And this is a tough question, because Darwin was always a little cagey when he was talking about religion. And he always talked of like he was conflicted. And he may very well have been. But I think there's a window, there is a glimpse of his real attitudes toward religion when we look at a meeting that he had just about 6 or 7 months before his death. He was an ailing man. He had a failing heart. He had had lots of health issues through much of his life, but certainly that last year of his life was a particularly difficult one for him. And he was not normally seeing visitors. But on this one occasion, he opened his doors to Ludwig Buchner and Edward Abeling, who were two of the most, I guess, prominent and vocal atheists of their day. They happened to be in London for a meeting. They wanted to meet with Darwin. They asked if they could have a meeting with him, and they did. They had lunch. And the substance of that meeting, Edward Abeling wound up publishing in a publication published a couple of years after Darwin's death in 1883 called The Religious Views of Charles Darwin. And he talks about that meeting and says the discussion at Down House, which was where Darwin lived, that occurred on September the 28th, 1881, in which Darwin's son Francis also participated. Abeling indicates that it was Charles Darwin and not he or Buchner who brought up religion. And Darwin wanted to know why Buchner and Abeling called themselves atheists. Well, they said that they did not want to be considered God deniers, but instead they were atheists because they found no evidence of deity, because the invention of a name was not the explanation of a phenomenon, because the whole of man's knowledge was of a natural order, according to them, and only when ignorance closed in on his onward path was the supernatural invoked, and that's the way they viewed it. Now, Abeling says that Darwin found himself corrected in his assumption that they were deniers of God, and he found the way that they were thinking not essentially different from his own. And Darwin's objection was really one of emphasis. He said at one point, is anything gained by trying to force these new ideas upon the mass of mankind? It's all very well for educated, cultured, and thoughtful people, but are the masses yet ripe for it? By it, he means atheism. So the issue really for Darwin was a strategic one. It wasn't a question of validity. All the parties seemed to agree that agnostic was but atheist writ respectable, and atheist was only agnostic writ aggressive. So when historian Maurice Mandelbaum says that Charles Darwin's agnosticism was really simply an undogmatic form of atheism, I think he's pretty accurate. Darwin had written to Abeling on this topic before and had again emphasized that he did not like the idea of promoting atheism really as a strategic method. Not necessarily that it wasn't true, but that it tended to have an adverse effect on the general population. You know, as any, you know, reading of Descent of Man makes clear, For Darwin, the concept of deity could be compared to like the devotion of a dog to its master or a monkey to its keeper. He actually makes those comparisons. With the idea of a universal and beneficent creator, simply an invention of man as an outgrowth of social development and culture. I mean, that's what it was for Darwin. So the point is, Darwin's ideas were really in fundamental agreement with those of Buchner and Aveling. Now, as an interesting footnote to all this, Darwin's son, Francis, tried to walk all of his father's religious positions back in his autobiography, which he edited in 1892. And in a note, Francis refers to Aveling's published accounts by saying that the reader may be misled into seeing more resemblance than really existed between the positions of my father and Dr. Aveling, despite the fact that he admits that Aveling's account is a fair one. The rest of the note lapses into a discussion of the semantics of what atheism versus agnostic means, which really just confirms Aveling's account in the first place. So he tries to walk it back, but I don't think very effectively.
Well, thank you, Michael, for this fascinating discussion. And I suspect in a future podcast we could talk about how materialism affects the adamant defense of evolution today. For ID the Future, I am Brian Miller. Thank you for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.